This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I'm presenting part 8 of my discussion with Mike Leland and Aaron Gullius on UFO history. Might be the second to last part. I'm sure we'll come up with a different variation of this to continue, considering its popularity and how much we enjoy doing it. But, yeah, we're almost up to present day. Where Did the Road Go? Is now available on the Google Play Store, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher and YouTube and all that other stuff. It's been on forever. It's working as of this broadcast. There is a link on the website, www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And I think that's all I have for you right now. So here's UFO History, Part 8. So this is Part 8 of our UFO History with Mike Leland and Aaron Gullius, and we're continuing this right along after part 7, which we've never done. We usually take months and months of breaks, but we're going so good tonight, we're just going to do the next part. And we left off last time talking about the key and everything, and in 2003, Sight Unseen was published, which was Bud Hopkins' last book with his later-to-be ex-wife, and her name is escaping me.
Carol Rainey. Yes.
There we go. Yep. Carol Rainey. Yes. And I thought it was a really interesting book.
You know, I point that book to people like, you know who I point that book out to? I don't know if I actually ever did. I might have over email or something. Is Paul Kimball is very quick to sort of like point a finger at Bud Hopkins and say like, oh, he's like just does, you know, he gets all this stuff fabricated from hypnosis, and he's just got this you know, one-dimensional view of how the UFO abduction event takes place, and I'm not sure whether Paul Kimball has actually said those words straight, but that's the implication that I get from the way
he's been. I know Kimball pretty well, and he's been more critical. He was more critical of he was pretty critical of Hopkins. Yeah.
So, but that book is so weird. That is like all the high strange stuff. And what I did when I read it, and I probably shouldn't say this, but so it goes chapter by chapter, just like so Bud Hopkins will write a chapter, and then his now ex-wife Carol Rainey would write a chapter, and he would write about the UFO research he'd done, they would talk about, you know, sort of cutting edge science that mimics the stuff, you know, like invisibility. Mm-hmm. Or mind control and this kind of things that would mimic what is taking place in the UFO contact experience. And I was completely smitten by the stuff Bud Hopkins was writing, and I just kind of glossed over the stuff that Carol Rainey, because I wanted to get right back into the other stuff. But there is some of the weirdest stories in which I'm much more drawn to is the high strangeness stuff. There's some amazingly trippy, nonsensical stuff, which I, in a funny way, I think they've tried to force it into this, like, oh, here's cutting edge science, can kind of attempt it, you know, make this stuff seem plausible.
Yeah.
But I didn't. But I just, I'm at peace with the total weird stuff. It felt like they were trying to make the weird stuff seem less weird.
Yeah, which I'm with you, Mike. I would much rather have people just sort of take the weirdness as weirdness, and
you can do that by skipping half the chapters in the book,
which also, you know, saves time.
Yeah.
So. the subtitle on this one is Science, UFO, Invisibility, and Transgenic Beings.
There is a great story about Mr. Page that lives in the basement of the house of this UFO abductee, and this woman who's now a grown woman, and I know some people who are in the circles of that were part of the Bud Hopkins support group and stuff, and are friends with the woman that they talk about in this. I've never met her. I've never spoken with her, but they kind of roll their eyes and say, well, she's had some real experiences and she's had some powerfully strange stuff. But she talks about this guy. She's a young girl. I think this is on Long Island. And this guy, kind of the strange man, comes to the house and says, knocks on the door and says, hi, do you need any odd jobs done around the house? And can I live here? And they say, well, sure, you can live in the basement. So he lives in the basement under the girl's room. And they never see him eat or drink water. He always wears the same clothes. And then he would just disappear at times. And he would write these postcards that were unintelligible. Like he would go away. I'm just going to leave for some time. And then they would receive a postcard. It didn't make any sense. The postcard would be in this like gobbledygook like nonsense. And that story, and then of Mr. Page, was so eerie and spooky. So that just for that story alone, though, you have to go get the book. Just even if you just read those 20 pages.
And don't they also talk about the infamous astronaut photograph?
Oh, I
Which one's
think
the
so.
astronaut photograph?
I think so.
Where they took the photo of the little girl in the park in England, and behind her is standing a man in full like astronaut regalia, and he wasn't there when they took the photo.
I don't know if that's in that book or not, but they do talk about some
I'm
photographic evidence stuff where it was, I think it was someone in Australia. There was a long thing about, which is very similar to that, where like UFOs were showing up in the photographs, but they didn't see them at the time. Yeah.
Is that
And
the
there's all kinds of time warp stuff in that photograph chapter too.
the name of if it's the same little girl in a picture with a mysterious astronaut in the background? I don't know how many of those kinds of photos there are, but
Right.
the Solway Firth spaceman or Cumberland spaceman from like it was like in the 60s or something like that.
Yeah, I think
Yeah.
so. Early 70s, something along those. I know Jenny Randles wrote about it in her Time Storms book.
It's a creepy picture.
Yeah, because it's hard to explain.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of it offhand.
Yeah.
But I thought they were using that as part of their explanation on the whole photography thing and invisibility and stuff. But maybe I read Time Storms around the same time and I mixed them up. It's entirely possible.
There's certainly a long section where they talk about some photographs that were taken at a playground in I think Australia. So it's not the same story, but it sounds like a very similar photograph.
And what was that one?
Yeah, it's been so long since I read the book. I can't do it. I can't do it. I've reread and reread the Mr. Page thing so many times that I feel like I covered that one pretty well. Mr. Page eventually takes the girl for like little walks into the woods. It's really eerie. It's like you could kind of read that any number of ways, but
Yeah.
so let's go for a walk in the woods, and then they're like, then there's missing time, and it gets, oh, it's unsettling, that story. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the Solway Firth spaceman.
Yep, Solway Firth.
Oh, I can picture the I can picture the image so clearly. I actually read something where someone said it was a person jogging behind them, and the way their elbow and their jogging shoe was like, created the illusion of and the special sort of windbreaker they were wearing created the illusion of a spaceman, and that
Oh man, no.
didn't work at all for me.
Yeah, it looks, I mean, it might be the fact that before I ever saw the photo, I heard it was a picture of a spaceman, but it's, it's
Sure
sort of.
looks like a it looks like it's a little bit like a balloony kind of spaceman. It looks a little bit like they could walk that spaceman, float that thing down
Yes.
on
Especially the way it's, if I remember right, it's sort of angled out to the
it's sort of
side
crooked.
of her head, like a weird hat. It looks more like a spaceman than anything on Mars looks like a face.
That's
I
true.
will
I
say
agree. I know with the Men on Mars thing, that's I know where we're going, so.
and it was taken in 1964.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's definitely a hard one to figure out. There's no, I don't think any easy explanation on that. But it might have been Time Storms from Jenny Randles that was in. It's entirely possible. So yeah, and then do you know how long it was before him and Carol broke up, Mike?
I do not know, and I was actually I was. I wouldn't say I was good friends with Bud, but I had worked with him, and I we were very he was very I found him to be a very thoughtful, kind man, And I worked with him in 2008, 2007, 2008, and he died in 2011. And I called him shortly before he died. And then I was, and when I talked to him, I recognized right away that, like, uh-oh. And I had a few folks that I knew that had worked with him, and I said, you got to call this guy right now. You might not get the chance to talk to him again. So
yeah. And well, the next event we have down here is also of that same ilk. Dr. John Mack dies on September 27th, 2004, hit by a drunk driver in London.
That is so easy to say it was a – I mean, I'm on both sides of the fence at the same time of, like – you know, because I've talked to people who have researched it and say, no, it was an accident. And people who knew John Mack said he was very much like walking around the streets of Boston was kind of the absent-minded professor. You know, he was, people were like, John, you know, like, be careful. And so he was notorious.
Right.
You know, friends had said that's exactly the kind of thing he would do was, and it was the case of being in England, you know, where if you
you're, look, you're looking the wrong way.
Patterns,
yep.
Yeah, you look the wrong way if you're going to cross the street. So, or an American would look the wrong way if they were going across the street. So, that would be, and that was at the height of, that was just after he was cleared he even used the term Kafkaesque trial.
Yeah, his tenure revocation thing.
Yeah, he was taken in front of and had to get a lawyer. And Alan Dershowitz, who was on staff there at Harvard, actually, you know, spoke and said, listen, this is freedom of speech. You can't tell the guy what he can and can't study. And, but basically, you know, like a tenured Harvard professor with the Pulitzer Prize comes out and says, you know, people are being abducted by aliens. And you just like you could just sense that they were like, holy crap, we got to get rid of this guy. We got to shut this guy up. You know, within the hallowed halls of that, you know, institution. And then right after he died, Susan Clancy's book came out almost immediately, which was just like, you know, and it had Harvard Press and great big letters on the front and stuff like that. So here's this woman, Susan Clancy, who comes out with a book that says, like, oh, people who claim to be abducted by aliens, they're just suffering from this kind of delusional thing. Isn't it interesting that they
– Was she sleep paralysis? Was she the one who
– I cannot remember. I actually never read it, but whether she – passed it off to sleep paralysis at all. All that was just so blatantly obvious that, you know, they were like, oh my God, he's gone. Let's get a book out right away. Like, you know, so,
yeah, the thing is for me, the likelihood that it was an accident just seems to be, it just seems more plausible that it was an accident than, you know, that somebody put a hit out on him, you know, wait till he's in London and then, you know, hit him with a car. You know, it just doesn't, he wasn't, I don't think he was threatening anybody, even Harvard, enough to justify that kind of response. Because honestly, you go to, you know, 9 out of 10 people on the street, even in academia at the time, and he said, have you heard about this John Mack thing at Harvard? And they would have said, what John Mack thing? So I know Harvard has a, you know, sort of very outsized view of its own significance and importance, but I don't know. I agree.
But at the same time, it is, you know, what I will say, so I can't answer the question, but I will say within the UFO community, a lot of people just take it as gospel, just as plain fact that he was killed.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Nick Redfern has written an entire book on all the weird deaths related to people who research UFOs. There's quite a lot of them. So, I mean, I would think it was just an accident. It seems like it fits with being just an accident. But, you know, who knows what's behind all these deaths?
Yeah.
No, it's worth looking into. And, you know, everything like that, you know, there were people with motives. But you know, there's... I don't know. It's, you know, it's not like when the conspiracy theories, sort of going back to the 90s a bit, about Jim Keith, for example, that his death wasn't entirely accidental. I think the number of people in significant places of power that Jim Keith probably angered with his research and writings is probably you know, more dangerous than Mac, you know. So some, I mean, I'm not dismissing, you know, these, you know, potential assassinations of researchers, you know, out of hand, but, you know, some are more plausible than others. And I think Mac is, you know, his prominence in the abductee field is certainly a factor, but at the same time, I don't know that the people he was angering were the types of people who would have taken him out. That's sort of where it falls apart for me, is he wasn't going after the sort of, you know, government, military, industrial, political figures that others do. And I'm trying to imagine a group of, for example, Harvard academics trying to arrange a hit, and it's amusing trying to imagine that.
And to me, he was like the mirror opposite of David Jacobs.
Yes. Yes.
You know, he had these experiences are transformative and positive, and yeah, there's the occasional negative one, but it's how you approach the experience.
And he was actually an expert in the field that he was actually working in.
True.
He was a trained clinical therapist. He was a medical doctor. And so he had every, you know, he's the one you cannot point to and say like, oh, this guy didn't know what, you know, how to use hypnosis.
Right. As far as institutions of higher education being irked by somebody embarrassing because of flying saucers, I think Jacobs is way, way, way further down the road on that than John Mack was. And I think the fact that Mack, you know, won his dispute with Harvard over his tenure revoking over that, I think that says a lot as well. If they wanted rid of him, they could have used their system.
Yeah,
they could have used their system and their board of trustees and all of the tools at their disposal to basically discredit him and shut him down. And that's the way to get rid of somebody like John Mack. Somebody like David Jacobs, you just sort of let them go and hope they retire soon. it was sad because no matter what the final verdict will, maybe someday we'll know if it was an accident or if it was nefarious. Regardless, it's sad, very sad, because he was a interesting and thoughtful scholar of the phenomenon who came to it with far less ideological baggage than a lot of other researchers.
I would say that also he was in a way predisposed to see a more he was friends with the Dalai Lama, and he mm-hmm. had studied all kinds of mystical traditions, and he meditated and things like that. So he was predisposed perhaps to see it within that way. And also, and I've talked to people who've worked both with Dr. Mack and who've worked with Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs, and the folks who've worked with John Mack said that he would get to a certain point in the research and then go deeper,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's the one that first started doing the, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I've read a lot of books and it all blurs together at some point, but it's in the book Abduction, where one of the people that he's working with, they got them so deep into hypnotic regression that suddenly they're like, where are you? And it's like, well, I'm in this other realm, and they basically say, I'm an alien in this previous life. This is a previous life, and I'm an alien. And then I have agreed to come and reincarnate into this person's consciousness, into this person's life, to be that I am the soul within this human, and that they are, and I've done it through reincarnation. So, and then they are playing an important role, and I have chosen to take this on as a alien being from this alternate realm. And then, and so, yeah, that was the very first, which is pretty far out stuff, and that has since become kind of commonplace in a way within the UFO research community, that people will tap into that. But that was, if I remember correctly, the very first time that showed up was in that book, in the book Abduction.
Hmm. So also in 2004, After the Martian Apocalypse by Mac Tonies was published.
That book just made me care about Martian anomalies. If anybody has ever heard me complain about Richard Hoagland, you'll know that's pretty amazing. It was an incredible book, and I read it after I'd started reading Mac's blog. He had already published it once I discovered Mac and his writing. I found a copy. I amazingly found a copy affordably, which was, after a while, a pretty difficult feat. And it was such a good case for examining these things without offering an explanation about what it might be. And without playing the conspiracy card about why NASA had been, you know, dismissive and reluctant. It was the antidote to all of those Richard Hoagland appearances on Art Bell. It was wonderful.
And I'm not exactly sure how old he was at the time.
Not very, because he and I were almost, we were, he was a month older than I was, and I was 27, 28.
He was born in August of 75.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He was born on the day that the Viking mission launched from Florida.
Oh, that's right. I remember him saying that.
So yeah, that was very early on in the book. He says, yeah, that's interesting. And I'm like, well, you know, that is the kind of thing that I see as interesting. It is so he would have been in his 20s.
Yeah, so 2004, right?
Yeah.
So he would have been 29.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is so presumptuous for a 29-year-old to just write, basically saying, in as calm and non-hysterical a way, is saying, like, well, NASA really isn't, like, doing their job. You know, they need to have, you know, archaeologists on the staff looking at the data that's coming back from the rover, as well as mm-hmm. the satellite imagery that's coming back. And, you know, so that why, you know, if we saw these images in Egypt or in North yep. Africa, we would send in a team of archaeologists.
Exactly.
And they're not doing that. And he basically, so I just thought that was so powerful that he would say that. But the book I bought used from, like, you know, Amazon or something like that. When I got it home and opened it, it was a signed copy. He had signed
oh,
it.
Man.
Nice.
Nice.
And I was actually pretty close with Mac. I talked to him a lot on the phone. So,
yeah, we knew each other online. We'd correspond online. It's always like, man, I'm gonna get to Kansas City and meet you. And he's like, yeah, come on out. And I never got around to it.
And I never interviewed him, and that just breaks my heart. Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't even know he existed until after he died. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So that 2009 is when he died. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And and the thing is, after the Martian apocalypse, that's kind of the way I looked at it. It's like, okay. These look like they could be something. Why aren't we looking at it?
Yep.
You know, let's, okay, it might be natural, but what if on the slightest chance it's not?
Right.
You know, that could be the biggest news we would ever know of.
Yeah. If you know, like Mike reported Mac saying, if we saw this in Egypt, if we saw this under, you know, on the ocean floor, there would be no stopping archaeologists from examining this. Yeah. And I can't remember if I read it in the book or if I heard it on various interviews with him, but, you know, sort of, he talked a lot about, you know, the culture of NASA and the conflict between the I don't have this straight, but the Jet Propulsion Lab people and the manned spacecraft people, the probes versus the manned exploration people. There's an entire institutional political structure in NASA, just like there is in every other institution. And I know we laid at least some of the blame for this on that. You know, nobody wants to go out on the limb when, you know, they could lose face and lose work and lose prestige to the other wing of the organization.
Right. And then he published, well, actually, no, that was the only book of this type he published while he was alive.
Yeah, he had a book of science fiction short stories.
Yeah.
Illuminated Black. Illuminated Black, yeah.
It says Illumined Black here.
Hmm. There's some letters. It's, yeah, it's Jenny Randall. It's a test for Jenny Randall.
There we go. Yeah. And he died on October 22nd of 2009. And what did he die from?
He died of an undiagnosed heart ailment.
Yeah.
And I had talked to him before, and he was in the hospital. He was working at he used to work at Starbucks as a barista. And it was just amazing. He's the most brilliant guy I've ever interacted with, really. And then he took on a job doing some crappy job, where they solicit calls at a call center or something like that. And then he passed out at work. And then he went to the hospital and they said it might be your heart. And they did a bunch of tests and nothing came out conclusive. And then within a month he was dead.
Wow.
So they don't actually know what it was. And this is another one where there's a lot of conspiracy stuff. And he was not pushing any buttons. I don't think. It's one thing to, if someone's, my sense is that the people that they're after are going to, if there is, it's when you're tabling and military stuff or government stuff. And if you're talking about consciousness and the really far out stuff,
you're
off limits.
Yeah.
I was driving in southern Utah when that happened, and I heard the news. So,
Just sort of undiagnosed heart failure, probably some sort of congenital, thing that had been wrong with his heart for a long time, and it just, since Mac died from that, I've known, two or three other people around the same age that's happened to. They have some fatigue or fainting. They go to the doctor. They say, some sort of heart arrhythmia thing. We'll check into it. And they die in their sleep, or they die in their sleep. And then an autopsy shows some sort of strange thing they were born with that was basically a ticking time bomb.
So when he died, and this is my understanding, he was found in bed. And on his desk next to his bed, he had actually, and I talked to him about it, he said, yeah, the last little bit for working on the Crypto-Terrestrial book, I just got the last little bit to do. And he had actually printed in paper and was making the final edits with red pen. So that was found near his bed. There was some stuff that the editor, Patrick Weege from Anomalous Press, had to piece together a little bit, but for the most part, the book was entirely done. So this is a very strange, if this was written a screenplay, I wouldn't buy it, but this is, that the author writes this powerful, brilliant book, makes the final edits in red pen and paper, and then dies, as far as we know, peacefully in his sleep, is remarkable to me.
Yeah. And he was just a fascinating guy, and Paul Kimball has sort of taken custodianship of his writings and has published, I think, two volumes so far of sort of the collected blog posts from his Post-Human Blues blog. And I wrote the introduction to the first volume, which has very little of the weird stuff. There's a lot of political commentary. It was during the run-up to the Iraq War. He's extremely frustrated at living in suburban Kansas City, and I said this in what I wrote in the foreword, but one of the things that connected me to Mac is we were both guys from the Midwest who were months apart in age, who went to similar types of small liberal arts colleges, I was sort of like, Mac is some sort of like, man, that could have been my life, not doing what I wanted for a living, but having the brain space to speculate on all this awesome stuff. And I sort of, it's like, we've been in the same town. It would have, you know, he's the kind of guy that he's the kind of guy I would have hung out with like my whole life, you know? And it was, and just even getting acquainted with him just online, it was like, yeah, this is, he's one of my people, you know? And it was just so, so sad that he's gone.
Yeah. And tell people a little bit about the crypto-terrestrials, the theory there.
It's, oh man, calling it a theory is somehow more giving it too much credit, but somehow underselling
thought experiment.
It's thought experiment.
Is perfect. That's the perfect word.
Thought
yeah.
experiment, meditation. It's, you know, there's this idea he had, and you know, people are like, well, he really believed that. I was like, no, he didn't believe that, but he was playing with it. That maybe one explanation for some of the encounters people have had is that there is a race of intelligent beings indigenous to Earth that have an evolutionary track that paralleled humanity, but for whatever reason, there are very relatively few of them, and they have found a way to stay hidden and stay out of our way, but occasionally our paths cross. And it's the book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, building on some of the things he'd written in his blog and expanding on those, explores this idea and shares some of the strange encounters that happen. And one of the things that sort of fuel this idea is that, like we've said quite a few times over the course of these conversations, that these supposed aliens from another planet behave an awful lot like us, and they act in ways that we can interpret and understand, whether it's the nature of our scientific experiments and only we're the subjects, not the scientists, or just, you know, the idea
facial
that
expressions.
Facial expressions, you know, biology, the whole hybridization thing. I mean, just genetically, I don't know how that works if they're not connected to us somehow biologically.
Right.
But it sort of grew on that. And it was a brief book, a slim book. It's a book I reread every October. It's,
oh my word. Okay. And yeah. And my illustrations, I did the illustrations.
Yeah. The drawings are great. At one point I misplaced my hard copy. And so I bought the Kindle version. So now I have both. So no matter where I am, I can read it. It's wonderful. And, he did some interviews about it that were really good and really, really interesting. There was an interview on Radio Misterioso with Greg Bishop.
And Paul Kimball.
And Paul Kimball, yeah, the two of them together. And then I think when he was working on the Crypto-Terrestrials sort of hardcore, he did a solo interview with Greg where he did some readings from what he was writing. I'm not sure if that one's still available.
And he read aloud. He read the very first chapter there, which is a short little chapter. And it was comparing and contrasting his cat.
Yes.
So let's say his cat playing with a laser pointer with his cat, right? So this is a metaphor for the UFO experience. The cat being cat-like has to follow the little dot, not knowing that the person, the cat is not aware that there's a person in the room with a little toy, with a little laser pointer, a little, you know, that's creating this dot. So the cat is completely focused on the dot while there's someone else just messing with the cat in the room. And which is a brilliant metaphor, right? So, you know, we're looking at the UFO, we're looking at the shiny flying saucer, but what's real, where's the person in the room with, or in the existence with the laser pointer. Now, I wrote a very similar essay. There's a bunch of stuff that this Mac and I like. Got kind of weird at a certain point. I wrote an essay before I had ever heard of Mac Tonies in November of 2006. I first heard of Mac Tonies when he was interviewed in 2007 on Tim Banal's program. And I remember I got up one morning, I drank a cup of coffee, and I'm like, oh my God, I got this great idea. I'm just going to write this essay. And poof, I just wrote this essay, which is not how I usually write. And it was an essay where I compared and contrast playing with my cat with a piece of string. and the cat doesn't know that I'm holding the other end of the string. Now, if you read these two essays, and I actually took the audio of Mac and my own reading of my essay and played them side by side, they're plainly making the same point. He's a much better writer than I am. But and now this is actually Red Pill Junkie figured this out. Now later, after this is okay, I'm jumping around a bit, but when Mac died, I was really crushed. I was really heartbroken, and it's like it was emotional for me. It was bad. I was, you know, whatever. There was the shining star of like the core group of my, you know, like a close friend had. It was anyway. It was bad. So I had talked with Mac about doing the illustrations. I got a hold of Patrick Weege and said, you know, I want to do these illustrations. Mac and I had talked about it. Patrick Weege said he'd already talked to Mac's mother, that there was some illustrator out there. He found me now. So I was received the document of the book, and I printed it up on paper. I put it in a 3-ring binder, and I was so nervous about reading this thing. I was so nervous. I had a deadline. They wanted these illustrations, and I was putting it off just because I was nervous to read it. It was just too hot button thing. So there was a day I was like, damn it, I gotta read this thing. So I'm sitting alone in the house. The house is quiet. I've got a cup of tea. I got my reading glasses on, and the book sitting on the couch. It's on the coffee table. I open it up and I read The Crypto-Terrestrials by Mac Tonies. At that moment, there's this audible clunk. And the video cassette, not the video cassette, I had a CD player that had one of those cassettes where you'd stack like six CD players. This is kind of 90s technology.
Six CD player, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So and it ejected. It was off. It, at that moment, when I opened the thing and read The Crypto-Terrestrials by Mac Tonies, it ejected like the cassette. And I wrote a blog post about that. And Red Pill Junkie, who's been on your show, I'm sure, said that it's like that was a laser beam. And Mac wrote about a laser beam, and you wrote about a string. And I have also written a book about like lightweight camping, and I'm all into this like, you know, like complete Luddite thing, you know, and so it was from, it just seems so perfect. Mac, like the futurist, was playing with a laser. Me, the Luddite, is playing with a piece of string, and then it is a laser beam. Like it's the closest laser beam to me in the room was in that CD player, and that was what made that clunking noise when that was. And I have no explanation. That thing had never done that ever before. The CD player was turned off, and then it just ejected that thing right at that moment.
I remember, I think the first time I'd read, you know, some blog stuff that Mac had written, and I'd read some that Paul Kimball had written, and I started listening to Radio Misterioso, and I heard the interview with Greg and Paul and Mac, and I think it was like Mac's first interview anywhere. And I remember it was May of 2006, and I listened to it driving from Cimarron, New Mexico, down to Roswell. We were out there, and I'd escaped my other duties for 2 days to act, and told my wife, "Okay, you do your work thing here. I'm taking the rental car, and I'm driving to Roswell." And I just remember listening to Mac and Paul and Greg talking about all of this stuff, the state of ufology and Mac's ideas and everything, while I'm driving across the desert to Roswell. And it was, you know, it got me really back into all of this stuff way more than I had been. And it was just, you know, the laser pointer and or string, you know, metaphor with the cat. And I, as you were explaining, you know, Mac's laser pointer analogy, I was just thinking like, oh my gosh, it's Plato's allegory of the cave, right? You know, the allegory of the cave, but in a way that, you know, you don't need to take a philosophy class to really grasp, right? So it's just a brilliant, you know, whether you're talking about it or Mac was talking about it, just a brilliant way of looking at this phenomenon. We are focused on the effects without knowing there's a cause behind it. And what happens to us when we realize there's another layer beyond that.
Yeah.
All right. And I plan on doing a whole show on Mac Tonys at some point.
Outstanding.
Yeah, get Paul on that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the plan. But you can get all of his stuff still. It's all in print, right?
Except Illuminated Black.
Okay.
Yeah. I think after the Martian Apocalypse, I think a Kindle version was released. So that is much more. Yeah, there's a Kindle edition for $11. So and the paperback has come down in price. I remember at one point it was hundreds of dollars to get used paperbacks of it. But yeah, it's still available, and Cryptoterrestrials is as well.
All right, so let's move on to someone a little more controversial in the 2000s. Stan Romanek.
Oh, jeez.
I've met Stan a few times. Now, I'm going to be very... So I've met Stan a few times. So I can't say that I know the guy. I would talk to him at conferences, right? So I saw him a bunch of times. I've seen his presentation at conferences. I'm going to be very cautious how I say this. Like, it felt like he had a speech kind of, you know, like he would give it, you know, you'd ask him a question, you could tell he'd been asked that before, and he would give you kind of the answer. Very gregarious, likable guy. So what I ended up doing, this wasn't scientific, this was just because he was kind of mobbed. So it wasn't like I did it on purpose, because he was kind of mobbed at these scenes. I would talk to other people around him. And say, like, oh, you've worked, you know Stan, right? And it's like, okay, what's up with Stan? It's like, oh, my God, I had this totally strange experience with Stan. And then they would tell me this really weird thing. You know, like, I talked to the woman who claims to have had his alien hybrid children and how they met. And she's a very, very believable person. And so, you know, and I talked to, I mean, some of the, you know, like, talked to MUFON investigators who had studied him and stuff like that. Like, yeah, well, this is what happened to me. And so everyone around him had these very strange stories. He writes in his book, I talked to the investigator who researched in his book, he tells about, like, oh, I was driving to the Skywatch thing at this park in Colorado. And as I was driving, this thing was hovering right above my car. It was this glowing orange red sphere, and I pull in and I'm totally freaked out because this thing is, as I'm driving, it's hovering right above my car, and I pull in and everyone in the park sees it, and then I talked to the MUFON investigator who studied it and said, yeah, that's pretty accurate, that's exactly how it happened. I interviewed everyone at the park and they all saw him pulled in with this glowing sphere above his car. So yes, I agree that his claims are outrageous at times, but also the people around him are telling these strange stories, and I can't imagine they're all lying. So whatever's going on there, I think there's a real core story to Stan Romanek, and that there's a and that he's a, I just want to say, I think he's got a way about him, and I gotta say he's done some things that have irked me, because I feel like I'm in his shoes in a way, because I feel like I've had some of these similar experiences. So when someone who claims abduction stuff says things, you know, kind of, I don't want to say, you know, he says stuff out of line sometimes, and it drove me crazy. Now there's also the issue of the being arrested for, actually he was never arrested, I think he was, oh, it never went, he was arrested, no. But it went to trial, and he's never served any time for child pornography.
The trial is actually scheduled for this August.
Oh, is it? Okay, because I know, yeah, that there was a detective who had been arrested, if I'm my understanding, I might be getting some of this wrong, for falsifying evidence, and that was the arresting officer in his case. So anyway, it's a very messy, ugly thing, that whole thing. So I'm leaning on the side of, it's a messy story, but I trust that there's a core story with Stan Romanek's experience. And maybe he, oh, the stuff in his book, you know, how accurate is it? I don't know. The stuff in his book, which I've read, is no more far out than what's been written in other stories by abductees. But yeah, I think he's an easy target in a way, because because he has that sort of pat answer sometimes. And I am very skeptical of the alien in the window footage.
And there was, I remember something about an implant. He said it was some like network show, and he said, "Oh, there's I've got an implant." And then
it was ABC Prime.
Yeah, time. And then it's like, "Well, can we do a test?" Oh, the implant disappeared. You know, so, yeah. You know, stuff.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
That's exactly the kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a 2015 video interview on the Peter Maxwell Slattery show. Romanek admitted faking the strange movement of objects that occurred during a 2014 interview.
Yeah. Okay. So,
yeah, stuff like that just. You know, it's if I'm looking
sets
for
himself up, yeah. So.
Yeah, if I'm looking for credible experiencers to pay attention to, he doesn't really make the list. You know,
and
just
I know Peter Maxwell Slattery. I've spoken with him at length. He's in the book. He has owl experiences.
Mm-hmm.
He's like he's got, in my opinion, he's an experience who's had some real stuff happen to him. Young guy from Australia, completely. I don't want to say egoless. That's the wrong way to say it. But I mean, he just like he's just says it straight up. And so Peter Maxwell Slattery is an interesting character to. And I've talked to Peter. I should be careful what I say, but I think that he's probably said it aloud. But Peter Maxwell Slattery like says that he remembers seeing Stan on board ships. And I've talked to a few people who have said that. So this is, I mean, that's like that he said it doesn't mean it's true. And that doesn't, I mean, that's not going to convince the, you know, the, but for me, all I can do is say that, you know, like there, I'm convinced there's a core story at the heart of this Stan Romanek thing. And there was a little episode where he flicked a pen. It's very obvious. You can see it very clearly. And that was in a original, interview with Peter Maxwell Slattery, which was done on YouTube. You can see it twice. He flicks. One time it's a memory stick. One time it's a pen. And in the moment, he's saying like, "Oh my God, that was like some paranormal forces and stuff." But Peter Slattery goes to from Australia, comes to America, visits Stan Romanek, interviews him. The next interview is side by side on the couch. And yeah, it's a very strange story. It's a very strange story. I mean, obviously he's faking that one event.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly faking it. But I still stand by the fact that I suspect strongly that there's a core set of experiences that to the Stan Romanek
story. And the boo video would be the video of the alien in the window, I'm assuming.
I am very skeptical of that.
And it says a video expert consulted by Romanek claimed that the Boo video would have cost $50,000 to fake. A Denver Paranormal Claims Investigation Group, the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society / Warning Radio, claims to have reproduced the video for about $90.
I think
he also failed the lie detector that George Norrie suggested he take, and he claimed that he had medical conditions that prevented a lie detector test from working on him.
Yep. Yeah, very. I mean, it's a mess. His case is a mess. Yeah, I agree.
He also claims he was set up by Norrie to fail.
I don't think Norrie would set him up to fail, but Norrie would set him up to
do well. Yeah,
to do well. Yeah, Norrie would love that kind of thing.
And spin off a web TV series about it. You know, the thing is, I mean. And, you know, his legal issue aside, because that's, you know, the courts will sort that out. Just like I said before, you know, you got somebody like Whitley Strieber, who's sort of at the center of this, you know, sort of cloud of weirdness for a good chunk of his life and sort of groping for ways to explain it in ways that are helpful to people. I think there are also cases of people who could maybe perhaps like Romanek, who are surrounded by weirdness and weird things sort of glom onto them, and the way that they sort of cope with it is, you know, this is an opportunity to sort of go on the make and, you know, not be entirely honest with it. I mean, for all his faults, I've never gotten the impression that Whitley Strieber has been, you know, actively deceptive about anything. But people who are exposed to the strange, you know, respond differently, and it's not always in a way that is helpful to them or those around them.
And like a lot of contactees, they may have had a core experience,
right,
and then just ran with it afterwards.
Yep. You start going down a road where you know, you say this one thing, and you start out with this is what happened to me, and then, well, and then it sort of builds, and you get this accretion of myth and hoax around it. And in this day and age, it's much easier to have those be exposed.
The thing is, you know, and I addressed this actually in the last podcast I put up, which was this woman who's a listener telling us her stories that she's all these experiences she has. But when I put up the Jeff Ritzman interview, which ended up being three parts, some people were like, well, I can't believe all this weird stuff would happen to one person.
And I'll jump in. I'll say that, like, if I'm doing interviews with folks and people tell me a one-off, like, oh, I had this one weird experience, like, I'm very skeptical.
Yeah.
People tell me they've got dozens and dozens of weird experiences. I trust them more in a way.
And I think the one-off can happen. You know, it doesn't seem like
Travis. I don't trust him. That came out poorly. So,
the Travis Walton incident. It seems like he had one encounter. And it doesn't seem like he faked it. I believe he actually had this experience, but it doesn't seem like anything else followed it.
When I've seen Travis speak and people raise their hand in the audience at the end of his talk and say, listen, have you ever had any other experiences? And he said, if I've had other experiences, I wouldn't tell anyone.
Ah, interesting.
So, and I mean, and here's someone who, you know, had what I consider a genuine experience. He was gone. He was missing for those days. He was gone. And you know, his life was basically ruined because of it was no choice of his. There was already a media circus in place when he, you know, arrived back, let's say, you know, when he returned, the media circus was already in place. So he was you know, two things happened. He was abducted by aliens, let's say, and that he was subjected to sort of demonization in the press, back to back, overlapping.
So yeah, I tend to look at the people who have had numerous experiences as the ones who are more likely genuine, because I don't think people expect that. I think people who are going to fake it are going to fake one main experience.
Yeah, like an alien in the freezer.
Right, exactly.
Was that Bigfoot in the freezer? I thought it was Bigfoot.
There was a Bigfoot. Yeah. We had the screaming alien in the freezer there. We talked about last time.
Yeah,
I can't remember his name.
Jonathan Reed.
There you go. Yeah. Where he killed, shot the alien.
Oh,
killed
I didn't follow that one. Yeah, there was another one. There was a case in which Mac Tonies and I talked about, which was super eerie, and I think it was in Kentucky rather recently, so it would have been in the mid-2000s. Where there was a screaming that the police were called into, and they couldn't find the source of this, you know, help me, screaming. They were like walking through the woods and trying to find the source of this, and it was coming seemingly from nowhere. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
And that was used as a subplot or a tiny plot element, let's say, in Whitley Strieber's book *The Grays*.
Also, in 2009, the Fourth Kind movie came out. And there were, and of course, this is one of these movies they build as based on real events, and they put it to the point where they had Mila Jovovich on one side as the actress, and they were claiming to show the real footage on the other side of the woman being regressed, and none of it was real, not an iota of it.
And I have no problem at all with, like, you know, a publicity stunt for a low grade horror film. I think that's, like, you know, that's William Castle stuff. That's, you know, thumbs up, more power to you. You know, and the problem was that the movie was just plainly, you know, a sort of a schlocky horror film with
it was awful.
Yeah, it was bad. Yeah. But now what does happen to me is you write a book about owls and UFOs, and everyone brings that movie up because it did have owls in it, which, in my opinion, traces directly back to Whitley Strieber's book *Communion*. And you know,
and they connected the whole ancient alien thing at the end as well.
Oh, because they were speaking that ancient language. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, they were speaking in Sumerian and stuff. And I remember hearing George Norrie interviewing Linda Moulton Howe. And he brought up the movie as if it were real, and Linda had to stop and go, that was a fake movie. Sure.
Oh, geez.
And he's like, really? But it said it was based on real events.
Oh my gosh.
Good, that's like, well, Linda, yeah, right on for Linda Moulton Howe. Yeah.
Yeah, wow, you know?
But I think a lot of people you know, kind of
still
grabbed
do.
Onto that.
Still do.
Yeah,
yeah.
Still do.
I get it all the time.
As if this is really based on something.
Yeah. It's like,
but and it was such a bad movie. At
Abigail
least
Tyler.
Done
that's
it.
Her name. Yeah.
Good.
Abigail Tyler.
Yep. Mia
Jovovich.
Yeah. Jovovich. Yeah.
Who usually does good stuff. I think the majority of her stuff is generally pretty decent.
Well, I mean, that had a good cast in that movie. I can't remember there was the, what's the, yeah, but it, so yeah, it was a crummy movie. It was a schlocky horror film. It was, but it, and it had a great publicity stunt, which
yes.
I, you know, which that's, there's, that's the history of bad movies with great publicity stunts is, mm-hmm. you know, like I'm all for it, you know, like that's right out of, you know, the Tingler where they had the seats electrified in the movie. So when, you know, when Vincent Price, you know, the everyone had to scream. That was the only way you could get the Tingler from not in getting into your body. And then people would scream in the audience and the chairs were electrified. So everyone would get shocked. You know? So that's right up there with that. So,
And I guess the final thing we'll deal with tonight, Bud Hopkins' death, which was August 21st of 2011. And we touched on it earlier when we were talking about Bud. And what did Bud die from?
But head cancer.
Okay. All right. Yeah. How old was he when he died?
80.
Yeah.
He just turned 80. And I'm good friends with Peter Robbins. Peter Robbins had worked with Bud for years and years. And I was very close to Bud. And, you know, Bud would basically say, you know, like, I want to make it to 80. So he did, and he died shortly after that. Yeah. And that was very sad. Very sad. I knew a lot of folks who had worked with him. He had hypnotized me at one point. So, you know, like I laid on his bed, and he put a blanket over me on his bed and sat next to me and hypnotized me. So I very little came out of that session that I hadn't already sort of written about, and you know, the memories were very clear. But very sweet guy. Now, this is also, he lived in New York City on 16th Street, and right around the corner was a classic sort of Greek diner, which are in the 80s, 70s, you know, for like up until about the 90s, those started disappearing and being replaced by more hipster things. But I went to this diner with him and sat with him and ate. I had a grilled cheese sandwich, and he had the same thing. He knew everyone in this diner. It was this really remarkable. It's kind of New York City scene. And he told some stories that I'd never, that hinted, not hinted. I mean, he very clearly had a deeper view of the subject matter than had shown up in his written work. And he was very aware of his place as the spokesman for the UFO abduction. It was very clear that he was the sort of go-to person. He was the on-camera guy that they would call, and he took that responsibility very seriously and wouldn't stray from a sort of an idea. Like, he didn't stray from that. And when you talked to him in person, he had a much deeper and more nuanced way of framing the issues from all his work, though he did not, that we wouldn't see that very clearly in his book. Sight Unseen, you saw a little more of that. So, so very interesting, remarkable, soft-spoken guy.
One of the things about Hopkins that sort of differentiated him maybe a little bit from some like David Jacobs was at times, I think later on, he would acknowledge that, yeah, all the attention that this stuff gets, you know, this might influence what people are saying and what people are experiencing. But, you know, then he, you know, through his expertise, he's able to filter through that. I remember David Jacobs when he spoke at my college back, and our history club advisor was like big X-Files fans, like, hey, let's get David Jacobs in here. So, brought David Jacobs in, and I asked him, so if people are hearing you talk about alien abductions, doesn't that influence what people think about alien abductions, or if they see it on TV? He's like, absolutely not. Nope. absolutely not, because you can go to Darkest Africa. I think he actually said Darkest Africa, and I'm like,
oh that's like something from
gosh. welcome to 1942. And said you can go to Africa and you know you'll find just the same abductees and you do as you do in Philadelphia. And I was thinking at the time, I was like, I really doubt that. I have a hard time believing it's the exact same experience. But Hopkins was a little more nuanced, I think, than Jake. Well, a little more nuanced than Jacobs is a low bar, but it's
now. I also feel like David Jacobs has done some real research and done some hard work. So I think it would be a mistake. Jeff Ritzman would say, take David Jacobs' book, throw it in the trash can. Okay.
Yes.
Or his books, all of them. Just you know, you cannot. And I would say, take David Jacobs' books and read it, knowing full well that he has placed his own filters. You know, he has his own filters in place, and you know, proceed with caution from there, because I think there's some stuff in there, those books, that I have, you know, and I think that's true of anyone. I think that's true of John Mack's books and my book and Whitley Strieber's books. I mean, all of us are coming to this with a preconceived idea, and we're none of us are objective. We're completely subjective, and the problem is that Dave Jacobs says he's subjective and is very objective. Did I do that right? I think I got
the other way around.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Objective, yeah. But all of us are subjective. Yeah. It's just the way, you know, our experiences are all different. The way we look at things are all different, and the way we think are different. So everything's always going to be subjective to some degree. But you, Mike, you know, walk in and say, look, this is really subjective. I've, you know, this is just the way I'm seeing things. And someone like David Jacobs doesn't.
Yep. But at the same time, like, I've been to his house and I've like stood in his office. And let me tell you, it is floor to ceiling. Cassette tapes of hypnotic regressions. Like, man, it means one thing to say that, you know, when he says, I've done a lot of hypnotic regressions. It's another thing to stand in his office and see, you know, thousands of them, you know, stacked up like one after another. You know, it's so it's shocking. Yeah. So he's been doing hard work. He's come to conclusions that, you know, I don't agree with. Keep going. Anyway, so I'm sorry.
Now, it looks like he was married to Carol Rainey for about 10 years. He divorced her in 2006. And it was around the time he died or was dying that she started speaking out against him.
Yep.
And that certainly was not pretty.
No, that was unpleasant.
That was a different category of mean. That's like mean in all capital letters, italicized, you know. Bold print, yeah. That was unsettlingly mean.
And
she may have made some valid points, and she saw some things from the inside. And you know, I mean, I have no doubt that you know, Bud Hopkins was at the forefront, right? He had no one ahead of him to say, like, oh, how did this guy do it? How did he conduct his research? He didn't have that. He was making it up as he went along, and then to sort of, you know, play Monday morning quarterback and say, well, like, well, he did this wrong and he did this wrong in his research and got these things wrong. So it just seemed like, you know, it just felt very mean. And at the same time, she may have made some valid points, but it just, to me, it just gets in the fog of her, it just seemed like vindictiveness. It comes out poorly. Yeah.
You mentioned in your book, actually, Ann Strieber saying something about Bud.
Okay, this is something I'm very cautious to talk about, just because it does. She's not here to defend herself. I've talked with it. Sure. So in the book, Ann Strieber claims. Excuse me. I'll trace back a little bit. Ann Strieber was interviewing a husband and wife team who wrote a book called Aliens in the Backyard, Rob and Trish McGregor. And they, have you had them on your show ever?
I have not.
They're great. They're great. You should get them on. They're amazing. So, and during that interview, Anne sounded very poor. She sounded very weak. Her voice was faulty and shaky and kind of warbling, and she was a little, she wasn't her normal self. She had been co-hosting for Whitley Strieber's podcast series for a long time and often had a very pleasant way about her. She had a very, very engaging way of being in a conversation, very much like, very informal. And then in this thing, she was a little shaky and you could hear it. And she at one point said that Bud Hopkins, all I can do is, and you can listen to this and go back, and I think you'd have to become a member of the Whitley Strieber site or the Unknown Country site. She said that Bud, while hypnotizing women, had raped them. And you can hear the pause in that where both Rob and Trish McGregor were really caught off guard. And it was shortly thereafter she had an aneurysm in her brain and went into a coma. So I'm not like a medical professional. So my sense is that you could very clearly hear that something was wrong. And I don't want to say she sounded like someone after a stroke, because that's not right. But she did not sound like her normal self. She made an outrageous claim, which I don't believe. And then also I would say that Bud and Whitley had a very open feud in the UFO community. The book Communion came out at the same time as Intruders.
Yes.
Bud's book Intruders came out roughly at the same time as Whitley's book, and there was a lot of tension and around that, and I can't address that now because I really don't know the inside scoop. But and I've also heard, I will say straight up, I heard Bud talk about Whitley sitting on the couch, me and him. He talked about Whitley. He did not do whatever he did. He was no big fan of Whitley, and that was very clear to me. And that was, so that's no news to anyone in the community. But that she would say that. Now, in the story, I don't know if I have time to go into this, but in the actual story is I had a wildly powerful set of synchronicities all clustered together involving an owl, me seeing an owl backlit by the sun while listening to my iPod on a bicycle. And I was overcome with a profound feeling of forgiveness. Leading up to that, I had heard that interview. I was angry at Anne. I saw this owl backlit by the sun while listening to Anne Strieber talking to me on a podcast that she had recorded some years earlier, 4 or 5 years earlier. And I was the sensation of forgiveness was real. It was palpable. It happened. And I don't know where to begin. So there's an awful story that ends with a beautiful story. Oh, and that event of forgiveness happened. I saw the owl backlit by the sun while on a bicycle listening to Ann Strieber talking to me on a podcast. I got on an iPod. I've 5,000 things on the iPod. That shows up as I'm listening, as I'm seeing an owl backlit by the sun. That all took place while I found out when I got home, while Anne Strieber was in surgery for her brain.
Mm.
Mm. Her brain was open when that happened. Her skull was. Well, yeah.
Let me ask you this: did Carol Rainey ever make claims like that?
I do not think Carol Rainey ever had made claims like that.
Okay.
I don't know for sure, but I mean, if she had, that would be the kind of thing I would know.
All right.
Yeah, I remember when the whole that I didn't hear the I didn't know about the interview and how it, but I just reading on the internet. Ann Strieber said, "What about Bud Hopkins?" And I went to the page and Strieber, he didn't say that the thread of comments underneath the interview, people were complaining about her accusations against Hopkins, and Strieber said something like, didn't really say anything about the accusations, but he says, well, you know, it's Anne's prerogative and her privilege to express the opinions she expresses. And I just remember thinking, this isn't really an opinion. This is an accusation, you know? And it was, but you know, I went back and listened to it, you know, months later, and she just does not sound well at that point. Something was off.
Yeah. And, I've had breakfast with Anne and Whitley. They were a remarkably tight couple. Mm-hmm. You know, they were very, very pleasant and peaceful to be in the room with together. They were, you know, they had a great chemistry between them. So, And that I wrestled with putting that in the book, that excerpt in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, should I put it in there? And I asked Whitley. I emailed him and I said, Whitley, here's the entire thing. What do I do? Do I publish this? He sent me a 2-line thing, came back in a single email. And he said, of course.
Nice.
So,
yeah.
All right. Well, this will conclude our part. What were we up to? 8?
8. We're up to 8.
Yes. Up through 8.
Should have one more coming for people.
Yeah.
I think we can get through the rest of them. However, if we have missed stuff, and I'm sure we've missed stuff, and you're listening to this going, why haven't they talked about whatever, drop us a line, let us know, and we'll include that in the next one.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you guys got coming up? Anything people should know about? Mike, we'll go to you first. Okay, Aaron, you first.
Aaron, go first.
What am I doing? I am at the, I'm appearing at a conference, the East Coast Paracon in Halifax, Nova Scotia, the first weekend in August. Kimball is one of the people who's on the committee organizing it. It's the second annual East Coast Paraconference out there. And I am going to be talking about the Men in Black. Some Men in Black stuff. So if any of you are within shouting distance of Halifax, come on out. Looks like there's going to be some neat stuff. Greg Bishop is on the agenda as well, and Kimball's going to be there. And there's going to be some. You know, it's one of these great conferences that just runs the gamut from Men in Black through psychic readings to ghost hunting activities and things like that. So, awesome. really eclectic. So, call your friends in the Atlantic time zone and tell them to head up there.
And Mike?
I am trying to promote the book, which has been out for 7 months now, the Owl book, The Messengers, and still trying to push that as much as I can and trying to eat, you know, to work. I went for 3 years without really much of an income working on that thing. I'm working on a follow-up book, which is stories that were too long to fit in the original book. Mm. So it's the working title is The Companion to the Messengers.
Oh, nice.
Or Stories from the Messengers. So nice. Longer format stories, which I actually sent one essay, curiously enough, relevant today, which is being recorded on Kenneth Arnold Day. I sent Aaron said, hey, can you read this?
Oh,
you're like a college professor. Like how, you know, like how is this? You know, actually I wanted, because actually you were in one of the footnotes. I was like,
oh, yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
So I was like, did I get this right? Am I like out of line here? So yes, yeah, so it was an essay on Kenneth Arnold, where he curiously enough has a pet owl, and that was kind of the, you know, the starting point. And then a lot of weird stuff happened to Kenneth Arnold, beyond just seeing shiny objects over Mount Rainier. And after that, I have no idea what I'm doing. So that should be published within the next few months. And then after that, I just will be, you know, who knows what the future will bring. So.
All right. Well, thank both of you guys, as always.
No problem.
Oh, you're very welcome. I love this.
All right. And they have part 8. Coming up next week, I believe we're going to have Jenny Ashford on talking about the Rochdale Poltergeist. Later this month, we have Gordon White who will be joining us, who is the host of a podcast called Rune Soup, which is excellent and has a number of very interesting books out. We'll be talking to him probably for a couple of weeks. In August, we will have David Politis back on and a bunch of other interesting stuff in the works. www.wheredidtheroadgo.com for all your Where Did the Road Go needs. And we're going to take you out with Strange Machine by Psyche Corporation. See you next week. Can't help remembering. It was just the night before.
just my future lies with you. But like any ignorant human, I have the will to choose.
Do that.